Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for the introduction. So what I'll be talking about today is essentially two topics. So one, the first part will be based on these papers here and also an upcoming paper with Wilfried Titoshi and Kai on a potential, I think, very promising source of gravitational waves in the very early universe. And the second half will be on the detection side. So I'll talk about new ideas of detecting gravitational waves in the very early universe. So to get started, I have this slide here of the history of our universe, starting over here on the left, when the universe was very small, hot and dense. And then as time evolved, the universe expanded until it is as we see it today. And a lot of the information that is on this slide, so a lot of the information about particle physics, about astrophysics, about cosmology, we know by observing photons from different epochs of the universe. But with photons, we can always only go back in time until this slice here, which is the decoupling of the cosmic microwave background. Because at earlier times, the universe was full of charged particles and it was simply not transparent to light. So if we want to probe earlier times, meaning higher energies, where we have more open questions in particle physics, we need to find a messenger which interacts with matter, with the universe, more weakly than photons. So this is kind of the key idea behind using gravitational waves as a probe of the early universe. And that is that gravitational waves interact so weakly with everything that even if they're produced in this extremely hot and dense universe, even if they're produced during this phase of cosmic inflation, they can still propagate through the entire universe essentially unperturbed. And then if we can detect them today, then we can extract information about this very early epoch. Now, the problem is, of course, the if, right? And if we can detect them today, because the fact that gravitational waves kind of don't interact with anything on the entire trip through 13 billion years likely means it will also not interact with your detector, right? So then the challenge is to build a sufficiently sensitive detector to be actually pick up the signal today. So the status that we have at the moment, we have two types of gravitational wave detectors, and I'll talk about both of them briefly. So we have pulsar timing arrays, which are sensitive at very, very low frequencies in the nanohertz regime. So if you want to translate that to kind of an astrophysical gravitational wave signal, that would be the type of signal you would get by mergers of very, very heavy compact objects, say supermassive black holes. And then we have interferometers, for example, as the LIGO interferometer in the US, but also Virgo and Kagra in Japan. And these are sensitive roughly in the 100 hertz or 1 to 100 hertz regime. And then upcoming, we have in this intermediate regime, we will have the space-based interferometer LISA in the next decade, which is kind of taking this interferometer technology to a new level. And I think from the point of view of cosmology, a kind of very interesting sort of open frequency band is here on the right, at even higher frequency than what LIGO can observe, because this kind of corresponds to extremely early times in the universe. And that's something I'll talk about a bit. So before going into any details, kind of a prelude on what sort of gravitational wave signals I'll be talking about. So the gravitational wave signals I'll be talking about are quite different from the type that we've already seen with LIGO. So with LIGO, we've seen transcendent events. So we've seen essentially a black hole merger, which happened at some point in time and space in the universe. And then the gravitational wave from that event propagated, eventually hit our detector. We saw the signal, then the event was over, and whatever we do, we're never ever going to go back, be able to go back and revisit this event. It is just past. Now, there's another type of a gravitational wave signal, which is a stochastic signal. And that is essentially really more like a noise signal. So it's really something kind of like it has all sorts of different frequencies, comes from all sorts of different direction, and is static in time. So you could, for example, imagine that kind of for every event that LIGO sees, there must be many, many, many more events that are so far away that we can't resolve them individually, but that all kind of contribute together to some kind of diffuse background of gravitational waves. So that would be one example of such a stochastic gravitational wave background, but also cosmological events, as we will see, will contribute to such a stochastic gravitational wave background. So we are here on Earth and we are essentially observing gravitational waves. They're coming from all directions, emitted at maybe different times in the history of the universe. And then we see kind of the superposition of all these signals in an instrument. And so this is completely analogous to what happens with a cosmic microwave background. So now we have these beautiful maps of the anisotropies in the CMB, and we do all this amazing physics. But if we think back to the 60s, there was this radio telescope, right, by Penzias and Wilson. And essentially the first observation of the CMB was the observation that this radio telescope was simply not as good as it was thought to be, right? That there was an unidentified noise signal, which was isotropic and static and all this. And then at the end of the day was identified as the relic radiation from the Big Bang, so as the CMB. And so here we are now at this point in time, right? So if we compare to the timeline of the CMB, we are now at the kind of the pre-Penzias and Wilson stage. So we would like to see this diffuse, unexplained noise signal that they saw in the 60s for photons. We would like to see the same thing now in gravitational waves. And so the observable quantity is the energy density per logarithmic frequency bin, normalized here for convenience to the critical energy density of the universe. So the outline of the after this preface, the outline of the rest of the talk will be that I will first talk about gravitational waves from what I call metastable cosmic strings, and I will explain in a second what that is, and I'll explain why I think this is a very promising source for gravitational wave detectors and for looking for the stochastic background. And then more on the observational side, I'll talk about a couple of ideas and also challenges in going for these very high frequency gravitational waves beyond the reach of LIGO. And yeah, I mean, please feel free at any point in time to interrupt me or to ask questions. I mean, of course, you can also ask at the end, but I mean, it would be nice to keep this informal, and yeah, don't hesitate to interrupt. Okay, so let's start with the cosmic strings. So the basic story behind cosmic strings is that they are so-called one-dimensional topological defects formed when you have a phase transition in the early universe. So the idea is you have, in the simplest case, you have, for example, a U1 symmetry like here. This is supposed to depict the scalar potential over the complex plane. Now we break this U1 symmetry, we get this Mexican hat potential. And now you can imagine that essentially in every point in space, this kind of the symmetry breaking field, right? So the Higgs field will fall down into a different point on the rim of this Mexican hat. And so you can have configurations in real space where essentially the VF of this Higgs field is, say, pointing outwards on a two-dimensional plane, meaning there's no infinitesimal way that you can align all the VFs afterwards, right? So essentially you can imagine that they're topologically non-trivial configurations where nearly everywhere in space the Higgs is at its true minimum, somewhere in this rim, but there's kind of one-dimensional strings where you still have the full energy of the false vacuum. And there's no way you can kind of remove these strings by any infinitesimal transformation of your Higgs field. And so this is called, this type of configuration is called a cosmic string. And a more general mathematical condition for this to happen comes from essentially, you need to kind of map the vacuum manifold here onto real space. And so the rule is that if you break some larger group G down to some subgroup H, then you produce a cosmic string if and only if the first homotopy class of the quotient group G over H is non-trivial. So now we get these strings, right? These kind of one-dimensional objects. And now kind of as time evolves, these strings can intersect each other, they can self-intersect. They kind of chop off little string loops because it's energetically more favorable to have a loop, because a loop can then oscillate and shrink under emitting gravitational waves. So the that's essentially where the main contribution to the gravitational wave signal comes from. It comes from these loops, which are kind of generated from the long strings, and which can then radiate energy in form of gravitational waves. So this is all the standard story about cosmic strings, long known. So now let's come to this question of metastable cosmic strings. So let's look at the situation where we break some large, we start with some God group, let's say SO10. We break this by an intermediate step. So standard model group cross an extra U1, which we could or could not identify as the U1 of B minus L. We break this down all the way to the standard model. So now we can look at first just the second breaking step, right? So we're breaking standard model cross U1 down to the standard model, which means we're just breaking a U1, right? And that's precisely the example that I discussed on the previous slide. This is the toy model for generating cosmic strings. So the first homotopy group is non-trivial, we get cosmic strings. But now we can also kind of, okay, let's look at the entire process at once, right? So let's really break SO10 all the way down to the standard model. Now you need to work a bit harder, but you can show that in this case, indeed, the first homotopy class is trivial. So this would-
Valerie, sorry to interrupt. I have a quick question, clarification actually. You will assume that the group that's broken is gauged, right?
Oh, yeah, correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, so this is exactly, I'm always talking here about local symmetries. Yes, okay. If it's a global symmetry, what happens is you have an extra massless degree of freedom, right? Mm-hmm. And then you can radiate into this massless degree of freedom, which changes the story.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right? Yeah, you have an extra decay channel besides gravitational waves.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, excellent. Right, so at this point we have somewhat of a puzzle, right? Because you cannot, I mean, either you form cosmic strings or you don't form cosmic strings, right? It cannot depend on the way that you do the computation here. And if you form cosmic strings in kind of the second step, then how can they not be formed in the entire process? So the solution to this kind of somewhat confusing result is that you do form cosmic strings in this situation. However, they are not topologically stable. So what happens is in this first step, you generate a different type of topological defects. You generate monopoles. So monopoles are essentially zero-dimensional topological defects. And then in the second step, as we saw, you generate the cosmic strings. So if these things just kind of happen first one, then the other, then you would get a network of monopoles and strings. The strings would typically connect to the monopoles so that you have a string with the two monopoles at the end. And then the string can simply shrink and the two monopoles can annihilate. So this would be actually, I mean, this network would form and this network would actually decay pretty quickly because there's nothing simply from preventing this decay process. The more interesting situation arises if you first have this process here, but now you could have a phase of cosmic inflation, which dilutes away the monopoles. And after all, this was one of the reasons why cosmic inflation was invented in the first place. So now we generate the strings, but we have no more monopoles in our universe, right? So at first glance, it seems that we have stable cosmic strings because there's not a single monopole left in the universe. However, the monopoles are still there in your quantum field theory, which means you can generate these monopoles via Schwinger production on the core of the cosmic strings. So this is a process which will be exponentially suppressed, particularly exponentially suppressed by the mass ratio of the monopole that you produce versus the string tension mu of the cosmic string. But you can produce these monopoles, and eventually, once you form the monopoles, the string will decay rather quickly. So you can in this way, by kind of with the appropriate ratio of essentially the two symmetry breaking scales, you can arrive at a situation where you have cosmic strings which live kind of long on cosmological timescales, but are still not exactly topologically stable. And this is now actually, so this is not, as you can see, I mean, this is not an exotic example, right? So this is actually something which happens rather generically, I mean, without wanting to introduce a measure, but let's say it kind of happens in 50% of the cases when you look at a typical gut models. So it seems quite plausible that if cosmic strings kind of were formed in the universe, depending on the embedding in the gut model, they might well only be meta stable or not exactly stable. And that changes the prediction for the gravitational wave spectrum. So if you want to compute the gravitational wave spectrum for cosmic strings, then the standard computation is that you say, okay, so this is the energy density that I want to compute, which in order to get that, what I need to know kind of the power spectrum, gravitational wave power spectrum emitted by a single gravitational wave loop, a single cosmic string loop. And then I need to know the number of these loops, how many do I have? And in order to get this, the energy density today at some frequency f, so the spectrum, I need to know how many loops were there at any given time in cosmic history which emitted gravitational waves such that after redshifting.
Hi, Valerie. Sorry to interrupt you. I have one more question. Oh, sorry. I have one more question based on what you said before you move in. So you talked about the gate versus via Schwinger pair production of monopoles. Yep. Can you have catalyzed decay similar to the thing that's happened for electric fields? Basically, you have some high energy photon comes in the vicinity of the string, pair produces two monopoles, then the monopoles radiate two photons, and then you get a cascade process that produces, that makes the string decay.
Well, but here you have, in the case that you're referring to, the usual string of production, you have kind of the energy provided by the electric field, right? And then say you want to pair produce electrons, positrons. Hence you can have kind of the incoming photon is essentially of the same type as your background electric field. Whereas here, there's no electric field involved, right? So you kind of have
there's no electric field. There is still a strong field that produces monopoles, right?
Where the energy density comes from to produce the monopoles is the vacuum energy density of the unbroken U1, right? So the photon has a priori nothing to do with the matter, right? The energy density which is driving this is the energy density which you still have left on the core of the string. Now, what I don't know is maybe if you had, so you would need kind of, I think, to do something similar, you would need not the photon, but you would probably need to use the gut gauge boson, right? So the gauge boson, which is associated here somehow with the string.
It's not clear to me that it matter because the monopole is charged under, I'm confused about this.
So the monopole, for the monopole, there can be different. So the monopole can either have what is called unconfined flux or not. So you could either produce a monopole which is not charged under any of the remaining unbroken gauge groups or not, right? Mm-hmm. There's three, two options that you have.
Yeah.
So yes, if the monopole is charged on the, say, the electromagnetic field, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then maybe yes. Then maybe kind of you could somehow have some assisted effect here. I'm not sure. I don't think anybody has computed it.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, carry on. I don't want, sorry to interrupt you.
No. I mean, I encourage it, right? It's good. Right, so here we need to get the spectrum, we need the power in a single loop plus the number of loops which emitted at any point in cosmic history such that the frequency observed today is f, meaning that of course due to redshift, the frequency at the time when it was emitted was something else. So in order to get this object, we need to know the number density of loops with a given length and at a given time over the entire cosmic history. The reason we need the length is that the length is directly related to the frequency up to the harmonic at which you oscillate, and the harmonic enters here. We sum over the harmonics in the end. And of course, you need to know the cosmological history. And then you do an integral over redshift, you plug this in here and you get the spectrum, right? So the tricky thing to know is to know this power spectrum, which means you kind of need to understand how your loop is radiating gravitational waves. And you need to know the number density, which you can get to some extent analytically by making a Nambu-Goto approximation. And then you can fit it to essentially big numerical simulations. So what I'll be using here is essentially the results based on kind of this paper here for essentially the number density and the power spectrum. I should mention that this is quite a topic which has quite a debate in the literature. But this is where the uncertainty enters, right? The uncertainty enters in determining the number density here, and to some extent also the power spectrum here. But now all we need to do in order to use this standard computation and see what is the effect of having these meter-stable strings, all we're going to do is we're going to essentially introduce a cutoff in this frequency integral, right? So this is a very, very crude way of doing it, and we're actually kind of currently working on refining this. But the first approximation, you can say, okay, everything is the same as beforehand, just that I'm going to make the assumption that at some point in time, when essentially this decay rate here that I showed you on the previous slide becomes comparable to the Hubble rate, the entire network just goes away because I produce my monopoles, and hence we no longer emit gravitational waves. So the simplest modification to the standard story is just to introduce a cutoff here, which is determined essentially by when the decay, the average decay rate, or the decay rate times the average length is equal to Hubble. And with that simple prescription, you can get analytical results. And in particular, what we find is that the spectrum at low frequencies scales as f to the 3/2. And then at higher frequency becomes essentially a plateau, so becomes flat. And the turnover point between the two regimes is given by this f star here, which not surprisingly depends on the two model parameters that we have. So it's parameter kappa, which was the mass ratio of the two symmetry breaking scales, and mu, which is the string tension of the cosmic string. G here, I should say, is just Newton's constant.
So Valerie, may I ask a question? When you talk about like the production of monopoles, what I assume is like you will have like a monopoles popping out like at random locations, and then like the system will continue to evolve, right? Evolution leads to a destruction of the string like in very short amount of time?
Right, so they pop out on random locations, but on the string, because only on the string you have enough energy, right? And then what happens is before you had kind of a long string, for example, right, which goes over the entire horizon and which is really stable, it's kind of just going to stay there. But now you break the string into smaller segments, and now the string tension will just kind of pull your two monopoles together and will annihilate them.
You have angular momentum, right? Like usually it doesn't lead to quick destruction.
Right. So there is, this is exactly one of the points that we're currently refining. So in this simple approximation, we really just put instantaneous decay. There's a paper by Leblanc and company from 2009 where they study kind of this process, right? Kind of flyby maneuvers of monopoles for them to, because of the angular momentum that takes them some time to decay. So that's an absolutely valid point, right? So our preliminary conclusion is that is a small change to the story that I'm telling today. But that wasn't clear to us before doing the computation. So it's a totally valid point that you have. And I'm not even entirely sure that my answer is correct because we're still working on it.
Okay.
But you could also have, so the easier answer would be if the monopoles carry extra charge under the standard model groups, right? So if they have unconfined blocks, then the monopoles would also simply be attracted to each other directly via gauge forces, right? And then I think the process would indeed be fast.
Based on my knowledge of the computations in the quark literature, I don't think that's the case. I think usually they last for quite some long time.
But if you have charged particles and they simply
There's angular momentum, so the chances that they will meet each other and annihilate is very little, right? Even if another question is let's say I really let you have your two monopoles meet, does it mean the string is totally destroyed right after?
Yeah, because the monopole is essentially sitting. Well, okay, you mean could it maybe kind of form a loop, right?
Yeah.
Good question. I mean, the string really wants to, I mean, the string has its tension, right? So it really kind of wants to shrink away. But yeah, I mean, I fully agree with you that this, what we're doing here is kind of, this was the first ever computation to try and estimate what is even the impact of this meter stability. And this is the crudest thing I think you can do. And I think it gives a reasonable idea for what happened. But yeah, I absolutely think that this can still be refined.
Okay.
Can I ask a couple of questions?
Sure.
So first one, the number of loops with length L, I guess you pointed out, there was this big controversy that's like generic type size of the loops. So are you saying you're going with the result of the Blanco-Pilado simulation?
Right. So there's various levels of controversies here, right? So one controversy is whether you go with kind of an Ambu-Goto description where you say you can describe the string as an infinitely thing, like really as a one-dimensional object, or you really go with a field theory, classical field theory, Abelian-Higgs description. And both have their pro and con, right? And if you go with the, so the first kind of choice here that we made is to go with the Ambu-Goto description, because that seems to be a reasonable approximation at late times, when kind of the string network has some time to evolve, and then really the witness of the string is very, very small compared to all other cosmological scales. The second then controversy is precisely like exactly how do we determine this number density? So one issue was kind of what is a typical loop size? The simulations of, I'm not sure if it's this paper or later paper by the same authors, but like the simulations of this group converged essentially on saying that the typical loop size at formation is 0.1 of the horizon size. But there's essentially another group, like Mary Sacliardo and company, who are having different results. And that I think is really still an unresolved issue.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then when you put the cutoff, I'm trying to see. So that's already also what kind of the cutoff is when the loop is a smaller than some size.
Right, so the loop here, so this is this gamma D, right? Is the one we had on the previous slide. Mm-hmm. This is the decay rate, or the formation, if you want, this is the formation rate of monopoles per unit length of cosmic string. So what I'm going to say is I have at any given time, right? I have cosmic strings of different lengths, but I can do an averaging process, right? And at any time I can get an average length. This is L bar. So I say when the average length times the decay rate per unit length is of order Hubble, right? Which means that during one Hubble time, I expect any string to generate a monopole or monopole anti-monopole pair, right? Okay, so and then I say this is the onset of the decay process.
Okay, what is the typical size then for this cutoff? Is it of, like you mentioned that the typical size of the loop was about a tenth of the horizon, I guess.
Yeah, so this is much smaller, right? Because that, as the network evolves, you have an old, you always form new loops, right? The new loops are big, mm-hmm. but you always also have old loops, and the old loops are smaller because they have had time to emit gravitational waves. And the smallest loop is essentially zero, right? Can't give you a number now.
No, I'm just wondering if the number go to approximation is still valid around the cutoff or.
Yeah. So really, the width of the string is really smaller than any other scale ever appearing in the computation.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, so then this is essentially just a plot to give an idea of the results. So this curve here, so the dashed are essentially just this simple analytical formula compared to the numerical formula, right? When we do the redshift integral exactly. But essentially now the colors here, so what I'm showing here is the spectrum omega GW as a function of frequency, with these gray areas denoting kind of existing or prospective experiments, right? Here's LIGO, here the pulsar timing array bounds. And this blue curve, this corresponds to large values of kappa, meaning large mass hierarchy, meaning long-lived strings. So this blue curve is essentially reproducing the old result of stable cosmic strings. And the old result was simply that for large values of g times mu, so here we have, for example, 10 to minus 7, which corresponds to roughly the gut scale in terms of energy breaking. This was simply excluded by pulsar timing arrays. And hence, if you wanted to, with stable cosmic strings, if you want to have a signal which is consistent with the pulsar timing array bounds, you had to lower the string tension, making it completely unobservable ever for LIGO. So that was kind of the old story. But now we can also, we have this additional parameter kappa, right, the mass ratio. So we can now kind of lower kappa, meaning bringing the two mass scales closer together, meaning we're making the strings more unstable. And then essentially this low frequency part of the spectrum gets cut off, because this low frequency part of the spectrum is precisely coming from the string network at late times, whereas this part up here is coming from the string network at early times, and we're only modifying the late time behavior. And so you could perfectly well have a signal which stays completely clear from the PTA range, but could be kind of really totally around the corner for LIGO. So I think this is, in my opinion, this is one of the relatively few cosmological models where LIGO really, essentially every day LIGO has discovery space here. There's absolutely nothing kind of excluding this type of scenario at the moment. And we're really testing here. So we're really testing kind of energy scales around the gut scale. And by kind of combining different experiments, you're really testing the symmetry breaking mechanism, right? So you can, for example, if you embed this in SU5, then this doesn't happen, right? So then you don't get the monopoles. And so you don't, you really only can have stable strings. So essentially we can really probe something about the breaking mechanism of grand unified theories by seeing or not seeing such signals. So that I think is personally, I find that exciting. Maybe any questions so far? Okay, so then of course, so this was the paper we put out in end of 2019. Then last year, NanoGraph happened, right? So NanoGraph is one of the pulsar timing arrays and declared a tentative signal in roughly this range, right? So we decided to chase an ambulance. So the story is that, so NanoGraph observes these millisecond pulsars. So these are kind of neutron stars which are rotating, and they're sending a very, very regular light signal to Earth. Regular because it's just the rotation period of the pulsar, at least in an idealized world. And now what you're going to do is you're going to essentially measure these light signals arriving at Earth. And if you kind of see some irregularities in kind of the arrival time, then that could be due to a gravitational wave passing between you and the pulsar. Now, of course, it can also be a ton of other things, right? It could be some compact object or something, right, which is distorting the light travel time. So in order to make sure that this is gravitational waves, what you need to do is observe not only one pulsar, but you need to observe many, many, many pulsars, like an array of pulsars. And then if it's a gravitational wave, then you would expect that the irregularities in the arrival times should be correlated in a particular way across the different pulsars. And then in September last year, NanoGraph published a paper where they say they find strong evidence of a stochastic process, which is a common amplitude and spectral slope across pulsars, right? So it was not just one pulsar behaving in a strange way, but they kind of saw a stochastic process across all pulsars, right? So this is a priori compatible with the hypothesis of a gravitational wave background. Now, to be sure that this is really gravitational waves and not some instrument noise, you need to kind of see this correlation. And so this is the current status. So here you have the angular correlation as a function of the angle. And the orange is the monopole, right? So this is what you would expect if it's not gravitational wave, if it's just some kind of if it's some instrument noise, for example. And the blue is the so-called headings down curve, which is the correlation you would expect if it were really a gravitational wave signal. And yeah, and the violin plots here are the data. So the conclusion at the moment is that the data is insufficient to discriminate with significance between the blue curve and the orange curve. So we need more data. But you can also see by looking at the plot, right, that this data is not incompatible with the blue curve either, right? So it's simply too early to tell.
Neil, go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, what was the orange curve again? Like, I didn't quite follow.
The orange curve is just a monopole. So the orange curve would be if there's essentially no spatial correlation in the signal.
I mean, no spatial correlation would be zero, not one, right?
No, there is correlation. Sorry. So there is correlation, but the correlation is no angular dependence. So they call this the monopole signal, right? So everything is cross-correlated, right? But kind of it doesn't matter what is the angle, you always get the same unit. Honestly, I don't know what they normalize. I mean, I think the reason it's one and not some other number is because this is what they normalized it to. But so
the idea is that it would be something that on the Earth that would cause.
Yeah, exactly. On the Earth would be the orange curve. I see. And so something happening at the pulsars, that would be zero everywhere except for zero.
Right. So if it were just happening for one pulsar, right, then yeah. Yeah. So the orange would, for example, be if you have some instrument noise, right, which is kind of affecting everything in the same way.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Was there another question?
Yeah, I had another question. It's going back to what you showed before. So did you take into account proton decay because you're considering specific gut models in the size of your signal? Does it agree?
Yeah. This is still fine. So typically this is now. It depends also on the coupling constants, right? But this is something like 10 to the 15, 16 GeV or something.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, but I think, it's really nice that these gravitational wave signals, they really probe the gut scale from above, right? Whereas it's the very other direction than colliders go.
So sorry, just to remind me, for this nanograv signal, so the signal they were seeing, that you were showing on your next slide, the correlation was like one sigma or something, right?
You mean?
Yes, it's blue curve. The blue curve was detected at like less than one sigma or something, right?
Right. So here, okay, sorry. This is the one sigma contour, right? The dark orange. And this is the two sigma contour, the lighter orange.
Oh, okay. So now I'm kind of puzzled by what this means. Okay, so for example, they can rule out omega equals zero at...
If you say, so you first have to decide if you, they don't say, the thing is you have to here decide if you want to kind of accept this or not accept this as a kind of gravitational wave signal in the first place, right? Of course, if you say, well, this is not convincing, if it's just noise, right, then of course you can say nothing, right? Then it's just some unexplained noise. But if you kind of say, okay, let's consider the possibility that this is a gravitational wave signal, then, I forgot what is their p-value here. I mean, they give it not in sigmas, but in p-value, but it's something like 10 to the 7 or so. So it is very, very, very significant.
Okay, but the thing that's very significant that was detected is the sum of whatever's happening on the Earth, whatever's happening on the pulsars, plus gravitational waves.
Right.
Okay, so I don't really care about what's happening on the Earth or like the pulsars, so if I only care about the gravitational waves, is that okay? Well, right. So that's so that's the blue curve, and that's like less than one sigma, right?
Right. So I think they have at the moment they really have excess noise, right? That's, I think, the statement that we can make, right? And at the moment, the data is not sufficient to determine if this excess noise is really gravitational waves or if it's just some other noise source that is not explained, right? I mean, of course, they make a big effort, you know, to understand what's going on with the pulsars and to understand what's going on in the instrument, right? And this is something which they cannot attribute to any noise source that they've been able to come up with, right? So it's just some extra noise. But it can, of course, still be some other extra noise, right, that just nobody has been able to figure out what it is yet. So I think in order, before making kind of strong statements, one really has to see if these violins converge on this blue line or not. If the violins converge on a blue line, right, then I think we have strong indication that this is really a gravitational wave signal. Then, of course, we still don't know it's meter-stable cosmic strings, right? I mean, rather the more likely explanation is, again, astrophysical, right? I mean, supermassive black holes are a perfectly fine astrophysical gravitational wave source in exactly this frequency and amplitude regime.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That'll also be interesting.
Yeah. But I think we'll notice, pretty soon, because they have, I mean, there's also other collaborations out there, right? So POX, pulsar timing array, and the European pulsar timing array. And they all have kind of similar amounts of data and they all kind of have similar types of analysis going. So I think this is something we'll know within months or something, it would be my guess.
Right. But can't they constrain the amplitude of, you know, of the uncorrelated the uncorrelated fluctuations, you know, by looking at zero degrees separation, right?
Right. So this they have already done, right? I mean, this is already just kind of the correlated signal that is left. Right, so I mean, they have to separate, as you say, right? They have to separate the noise of the individual pulsars, which will be uncorrelated, from the instrument noise, which will be correlated but a monopole, from the actual gravitational wave signal, which will be correlated following this curve. And they have very complicated models for all of this, right? And I'm not at all an expert on any of this. But kind of their statement is that they have a residual signal, which they cannot explain by any other means, and which they don't have enough significance to determine if it kind of passes this crucial test or not.
Okay, great, thank you.
Right, so let's, anyway, that was enough motivation for us to chase the ambulance, right? So here, the orange is kind of the nanograph, like if interpreted as a gravitational wave signal, the orange is kind of the nanograph signal in terms of amplitude and tilt. And then these curves here, and I apologize for the bad quality, I don't know what happens, but these curves here are essentially the predictions now in the model. So for different values of g mu and different values of kappa, the blue is what is already excluded by LIGO, in particular the recent LIGO paper. The gray up here is what is excluded by CMB observations. And so you're kind of left with some region here for kind of moderate values of G mu and some particular values of kappa, where, you know, it's kind of tough with the one sigma regime. It would fit with the two sigma regime. So again, the conclusion is we need to wait to kind of see if the data is or is not compatible with this model prediction. So I think it's the conclusion here is to simply stay tuned for more data first to see, is it a gravitational wave signal at all, right? And if it is a gravitational wave signal, kind of get more precise information, in particular on the tilt. The tilt is essentially unconstrained at the moment. And that would kind of allow us to make more concrete statements. Okay, any more questions on this first part? Okay, so I'm now going to...
I have a question. I mean, you say that the proton decay is a bound from below, right? The proton decay has to be larger than something. The scale has to be larger than something. So if you take a specific gut model, can you have a G, like a value for G Newton times nu of 10 to the minus 9?
I guess it depends on the gut model, huh? I totally see your point. So it's scaled as, so mu scaled as energy scale squared, as V squared. This is actually, yeah, I've never thought about it. This is actually an interesting point, right? Because in particular with the stable strings, with the stable strings, people are now making statements that, okay, since pulsar timing array puts so restrictive bounds, right? Can you nowadays say, okay, we can probe with Lisa, we will be able to probe G mu down to 10 to minus 11 or something. Mm-hmm. But then the question is that even compatible with proton decay? Well, I guess you could always, okay. So one thing you could always wiggle your way out and by saying, okay, this is just not at all anything to do with actually gut symmetries, but it's just
exactly. Some
additional U1 which you tag on, right? And then you can do it.
Yeah, but yeah, I mean that you can always do.
This is interesting. Yeah, let me think about it, because I mean, at least our motivation here is clearly really coming from gut model building. I don't just want to tag on an extra U1. If that puts a lower, what is the generic lower bound on G mu in this case? Yeah.
But the other thing, given that you're talking about gut model building, this is going another way completely. Are you considering a supersymmetry talking about the blast from the past? Because supersymmetric models are the best ones that have super unification.
Right. So I didn't put the reference here. So our initial motivation to even get started on this project was model from my PhD thesis, which was essentially B minus L breaking in the early universe in a supersymmetric model. And that kind of gave us, you know, was interesting for cosmological reasons and gave us kind of very precise predictions for G mu. Hence really a clear prediction for LIGO. So I'm not going into this here, right? Because otherwise I go even more over time. You can totally do this. Yes. I fully agree with what you say. So what essentially changes is that you have to take into account, the cosmic string computation really doesn't change much. Take into account the extra degrees of freedom and these things, but it's not a big change.
Yeah, fine.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry.
No, this is good. So I'm going to be super fast on the second part. So the second part is maybe even more, you know, it is even more speculative, right? It's about ideas of thinking about at one point in the time, or at some point in the future, be able to measure gravitational waves at even higher frequency. The motivation being that kind of, apart from cosmic strings give you a nice broadband signal, right? Though it does also extend up to very high frequency. But a lot of cosmological processes, which are kind of happened at one point in time in the very early universe, they will give you a signal at these very high frequencies and not at lower frequencies. On the other hand, astrophysical objects tend to not give you signals at high frequencies, right? Which is, I think, also why that was maybe not so promising for experimentalists. But kind of from my cosmologist point of view, that's fantastic, right? Because it's a background-free search. So we skip this. This is the situation we have, right? So theorists can come up with all sorts of models, right? And we can do this essentially at any frequency. And the only constraint that we have to our imagination is that we have to respect the BBN bound, meaning that gravitational waves are massless degrees of freedom. So we kind of cannot add too much massless degrees of freedom to the standard model without making a problem with BBN or CMB. On the other hand, if you're an experimentalist, you're not actually measuring energy densities. You're measuring displacements. And displacements are related to your energy density by the frequency. So to kind of get at the same energy density at higher frequencies means you have a smaller displacement. So actually, from the point of view of the experimentalist, the BBN bound looks like this. So even if they manage to kind of maintain the same displacement sensitivity at high frequencies, and this is a relative displacement sensitivity, which means they have to crazy increase their absolute displacement sensitivity at high frequencies, even then the cosmologically interesting signals move further and further and further away. So these are kind of the two problems in going to high frequency. So one is you have to go to extremely small absolute displacements, and LIGO is already measuring the diameter of a proton, right? So how much further can you go? I mean, with interferometers, I think not much further. And the second thing is that you really need to, like, because at high frequency, each gravitational wave carries more energy, kind of you need to go to extremely good sensitivities to actually see the displacement. So we had this workshop in Trieste 2 years ago, where we brought together a group of experimentalists and theorists to kind of discuss the motivations, discuss the issues. It was super, super interesting. And one of the ideas that came out of this, so this is work with Camilo Garcia-Celi, a postdoc at DESI. So one of the things that came out of this is kind of a cosmological gravitational wave detector using the Gerstenstein effect. So the Gerstenstein effect is the conversion of gravitational waves into photons in the presence of a background magnetic field. So this is exactly the same process as you may know from axions, right? Axion to photon conversion in a cavity with a B field. The same thing works with gravitational waves. So this is just electromagnetism plus general relativity, right? No new physics needed. And so the idea is to use cosmic magnetic fields to convert a gravitational wave source of the early universe into photons that we can observe today. And the frequency here is 1-to-1. So whatever frequency your gravitational wave has will be transmitted to the photon. So we chose here to look at photons and hence gravitational waves in the radio range. So in particular, we focused on the radio telescopes, RK2 and EDGES, which operate in the Rayleigh Jeans tail of the CMB spectrum. And so now you can compute the probability of such a conversion by doing the line of sight integral over the entire distance that the gravitational wave travels. And of course, this vertex is tiny, right? If you think in terms of this of axion decay constant, right, then you have a suppression here of 1/m Planck. So this is tiny, but your detector is huge, right? Because your detector is the size of the universe. So the idea is to kind of beat the tiny, tiny conversion rate by just having a huge time or huge distance where this conversion can occur. So then you can compute the gravitational wave signal, which will depend on two things. It will depend on your initial gravitational wave field strength, right? So you essentially will place a bound on essentially the gravitational wave field strength. And it will depend, of course, on the strength of the cosmic magnetic field, which is also something we don't know very well at all. So in the left plot here, I'm showing the constraint that we have for magnetic fields as a function of coherence length. So the gray regions here are the regions that are excluded or disfavored by various cosmological and astrophysical constraints taken from this paper here. And the colors here are simply just a way to color code in this plane. It's essentially I'm just color coding this plane. So in the end, this is related to the conversion probability of gravitational waves into photons. But for the moment, you can just imagine these colors here as a way of color coding this plane. And now I can, with this knowledge of the magnetic field or with this parameterization of the magnetic field, I can put a bound now on the characteristic strain of my gravitational wave source as a function of the frequency. And we have EDGES and arcade at their respective frequencies. And the bounds that we now put will depend on the strength of the magnetic field. So if the magnetic field in reality turns out to be kind of close to these upper bounds, then we can place a relatively strong bound. Whereas if the magnetic field turns out to be rather weak, so more in this yellow regime here, then we can only place a relatively weak bound. And for comparison, these Roman letters here are existing laboratory constraint on gravitational waves at these frequencies. So depending on the magnetic field that actually is in the universe and our ability to maybe one day determine it, this could outdo existing laboratory experiments, but it is still insufficient to actually probe cosmological sources, meaning it is insufficient to get below the ineffective constraint, right? So this can could at the moment only be used to detect either late time sources, right, which are not subject to the ineffective constraint, or extremely spiky sources or extremely spiky spectra, none of which have a fantastic motivation, really, right? So to us, this is at the moment just kind of a proof of concept. I mean, all we did is we took the existing data and we just kind of converted the existing bounds into like existing measurements of essentially the CMB temperature by these telescopes into bounds on gravitational waves. But kind of with the kind of progress in radio astronomy, maybe something interesting can come out of this at some point. I mean, also one can also look, I mean, we did it here with the cosmological magnetic field, right? One can also look at various astrophysical objects which have large magnetic fields. There is a trade-off between the size of the object and the strength of the field, right? And I think it's not quite clear yet kind of what is actually the best. This is the best scenario we found so far, but it may not be the end of the story.
May I ask a question? Like, what did you put in like as the plasma frequency here for the photon?
We did the integral over redshift. So we took the I mean the plasma frequency, right, depends on the depends on the electron density, which depends on redshift.
And you are saying like even with that taken into account, like you are still converting with coherence lenses or for the megaparsec?
Yeah, good point. So there's a this is just the coherence length of the B fields, right? Actually, if we go here, there's an averaging bracket here that I did not explain, right? Because so actually, essentially, the way we think about it is you have your kind of your conversion process, right? And you can essentially divide your universe into kind of patches where you have constant B field, and constant and homogeneous electron density, right? And kind of within that patch, you have a coherent conversion, but then at some point that patch is over, right? Either because your B field becomes inhomogeneous or because your electron density becomes inhomogeneous and the electron density enters precisely to the plasma mass. And hence, then you kind of enter a new box, right? So then you can kind of do a statistical analysis of kind of how many boxes do you go through? What is the conversion probability in each box? And you can kind of compute what is the probability of not converting, right? And then one minus that is your probability of converting. Yes, absolutely. Okay, so yeah, so that's kind of a bit the status, right? So I think this is kind of an interesting idea, though not yet kind of at the level that one can really constrain, I think, realistic cosmological models yet. So the kind of the status at the moment is, which is also summarized in this recent white paper here, is that kind of we have a whole bunch of kind of ideas for detectors, both in the lab and kind of in the universe, and a whole list of kind of cosmological sources that we're excited about. At the moment, none of these detector concepts reaches the sensitivity that you would require to actually detect any of these sources. But I think, you know, the gravitational waves came a long way. This frequency regime is something people have not thought about yet much. So yeah, we started an initiative which is just aimed at bringing people together to think about this question. And so if you're interested, let me know and we'll see what comes out of this. Okay, so with that, I conclude. So I talked about two things, right? The first thing is that these metastable cosmic strings are actually kind of a fairly generic byproduct of grand unified theories, which really gives you a possible discovery space at all types of gravitational wave detectors that we have, so both in pulsar timing arrays and in interferometers. And in particular, it gives kind of discovery space to LIGO, which is not constrained by pulsar timing arrays yet. And then in the second part, I talked about ideas on how to look for these ultra high frequency gravitational waves. And I think this is something where we're still at the very beginning and we're kind of really still crunching ideas. And we'll see what comes out of it. And kind of to stop with a quote, because I mean, as I said, right at the moment, none of these ideas reached the required sensitivity. But I just want to cite this quote from these three gentlemen from 74, where they said such detectors, and they were referring to laser interferometers, have so low sensitivity that they are of little experimental interest. And as you know, this guy here got a Nobel Prize in 2016 for the detection of gravitational waves with a laser interferometer. So we take this as a word of encouragement, and then maybe one day these things will actually happen. Okay, before going to questions, I just want to flash one slide, and that is a workshop we're organizing next week at CERN about making high energy physics more sustainable. So if you're interested in that, the registration is still open. Okay, back to science and questions.
Actually, I have one question about the last part. So if you say that you see such signal, even if it's above the ineffective bound, how would you convince yourself that it's coming from gravitational waves, from the shape of the spectrum, or?
Yeah, that's a very good question, right? Because you could argue that both edges and arcade, right, are seeing, because like essentially a signal here means excess photons, right? It's like kind of an increased CMB temperature. So you could argue that both edges and arcade see an excess in some sense. Do we claim that it's gravitational waves, right? No. Because simply we cannot come up with any sensible model that would possibly do it, right? So yes, I mean, I said before that this is kind of background-free search in the sense that there's no astrophysical gravitational wave sources, but of course there's many, many astrophysical photon sources, right? So the kind of the handle that you have is one, the spectral shape, and two, kind of the isotropy of the signal. So if, for example, let's say it's a stochastic background, a cosmological stochastic background, right, then it would be kind of a leading order isotropic, but it would reflect the dipole of the CMB, right, because it would be isotropic in the cosmic rest frame. So imagine you could measure an excess signal, you would convince yourself that it is isotropic, but that it has a dipole which matches in direction and amplitude the dipole of the CMB. Then you can exclude a bunch of astrophysical sources, right? And it is either something about the CMB itself or somehow something related to a cosmological stochastic gravitational wave background. Now, of course, you could also look for other gravitational wave signals here, right? It doesn't have to be a cosmological background. You could also look for astrophysical gravitational wave signals with this method, right? So then it would be not isotropic, right? Then you could maybe you could kind of see where is it coming from, right? And then you would kind of have to think about possible sources. But I think in the end, what you would see here is excess photons, and there will always be kind of competing explanations for excess photons, I think. But it still is, in some sense, it's still more useful in some sense than the ineffective bound, right? Because say if ineffective is, say, instead of a bound, right, it gives us maybe some, at some point, maybe gives us some 5 sigma indication that there's some excess radiation, then it's even more difficult to pinpoint this to gravitational waves, because we wouldn't even know the frequency, right? It would just really be a total energy contribution. It could really be anything. So at least here you can get a handle on what is the frequency regime.
Right. Thanks.
I think we need to thank Valerie for her talk.
Yeah.
Thank you, Valerie.
Sorry, I was just waiting to do that because she asked Darty for questions, so I didn't want to. But yeah, thank you very much. It was a very nice talk and very clear. Any more questions? If not, maybe I have also one more question regarding the first part. You showed is the region of for this nanograph possible detection. Would you also, within your model, would you also expect something in LIGO for the parameters?
Yeah, absolutely, right? I mean, so it depends on the value of G mu. So actually, this is okay. So in this paper here, so this paper came out before the newest LIGO bound, right? And so this was at the time. This was like this model I mentioned, right? Which kind of does all this nice cosmological stuff and is super predictive. This essentially predicted more or less this value for G times mu, which at the time was kind of just by coincidence just at the LIGO constraint. Now, essentially, the LIGO constraints have gotten a bit stronger with the paper that they put out today, right? So now, actually, this is now excluded, right? So now it's excluded down to 2 × 10⁻⁶. But absolutely, right? You can really get, depending on the value of kappa and G mu, you can really totally get signals of LIGO.
Sorry. So you said what value? 10⁻⁻⁶ what?
So the newest LIGO bound goes down to something like, so it depends on how they do the analysis, right? They use different types of priors. But they can, the sort of conservative bound is something like 10⁻⁷ now. And the more aggressive bound is a few times 10⁻⁸.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Okay.
It got better, not worse.
Yeah, thanks.
But then one should also say that there's really, I mean, there's like order one numbers here should not be trusted, right? Because of these uncertainties simply in the cosmic string modeling that I mentioned at the beginning.
But how much uncertainty is there in that?
Well, so if the uncertainty between, if I go to the extreme case, right? Mm-hmm. And say, okay, let's compare Nambu-Goto, this Nambu-Goto story, but with the Abelian Higgs computations, then it's something like 5 orders of magnitude or so. But yeah, if we're kind of just within the Nambu-Goto models and just kind of discussing, is the key signal between, is it kinks or is it cusps or what is the actual main, like what is the fine structure of the loop, right? Then we're more down to a factor 10, I would say.
I see. Perhaps we can stop the recording and ask more questions afterwards. If you don't.
We can thank Barry again. Thank you very much.